Okay, so I have no idea how this is how the material I'm presenting will go here. So if you have questions, just stop and ask. I have more slides than I put on the direct path of the presentation, so I may even be able to answer some of the questions. I must first of all to say that all of this has been collected with a lot of collaborators, of course. So there's the list of my students in Jerusalem, and then some of the data that I will be showing was collected at Johns Hopkins. Some of the data I will be showing was collected at Johns Hopkins with Eric Young and his student Mike Anderson. Now, what I'll try to do is to start with a relatively long introduction about the auditory system. The reason is that I would like to make the point that it's a very interesting system for theoreticians to look at. It's much more complicated, very different from the visual system, which is the paradigmatic sensory system. So I think it's worthwhile knowing a little bit of background to have a little bit of background. And then I will show three pieces of data that we have using different methods, different stimuli, that suggest that the auditory system is really involved in relatively complex signal analysis, in what we call auditory scene analysis. The idea is that at the output, the neurons of the auditory cortex really code less for the actual physics of the sound and more for sound sources, different sound sources in the environment. So we record from anesthetized cats, but lightly anesthetized, allostatin anesthetized cats. We keep them as light as we can. We record extracellularly with usually four electrodes simultaneously. But I will show you relatively little amount of data on correlation analysis. And what should be taken into account when looking at this data is that spike rates in the cortex are low. People tend to analyze information in the auditory system usually by quantifying responses as spike rates. In the cortex, spike rates are problematic because you have relatively few spikes per stimulus. Very often, for simple stimuli, you get a single spike that's locked in time to the stimulus onset. This is how you know it's a response. But the spike rates are low, even if you succeed in driving the neuron seriously. A lot of the analysis that I will show you really emphasizes changes in the temporal patterns of the spikes rather than changes in the number of spikes that are evoked by stimulus. So let's start with the introduction. Everybody knows about the visual system. And there are two ideas that about the organization of the visual system. One of them I will try to demonstrate in the auditory system. One of them is the idea of anatomical hierarchy, where you have the peripheral receptors going through the retinal ganglion cells with the bipolar cells in the middle, and then flowing through the central nervous system, the geniculate, V1, and so on. And the other idea is an idea of a functional hierarchy, where the retinal ganglion cells are simple in the sense that they have a center surround receptive field. Not necessarily very simple, but simpler than what happens afterwards. In V1, we have an emergent property, which is the directional selectivity and the orientation selectivity. And then somehow you have more and more complex neurons as you go up in the anatomical hierarchy until you get face cells or things like that. Now, in the auditory system, you have also simple feature detectors at the periphery. The simple feature detectors, the simple peripheral receptors of the auditory systems are narrowly tuned in frequency. So this is an example of a threshold tuning curve. So it's a neuron that we recorded in the cochlear nucleus. It's a neuron that looks pretty much like its peripheral input. It's almost follow spike by spike, the peripheral input. And what I plot here is the tone threshold as function of frequency that is needed in order to drive the neuron above its baseline rate. So there's a range of frequencies, a narrow range of frequencies, at which the threshold is very low. And as you go to frequencies below or above this narrow range of frequencies, then thresholds become much higher. So we tend to think about this neuron as a neuron that responds to energy in this narrow frequency range. Yes. Why do I show this way of representing it? This is how you usually see it in the books. I will show you later. This is the standard way of doing it in the auditory system. It's not. I mean, there's a lot of fine print happening when you look at this area. I mean, below the threshold, the neuron will fire at its spontaneous rate, and there's nothing interesting. Okay, so this is really changes between the area where there's nothing interesting and the area in which there is something interesting happening, but it doesn't tell you what are the interesting things that are happening. Okay? So what I observe above this line always is an increase in firing rate in this neuron. Now, this is a peripheral neuron. So in this neuron, firing rate is a very good indication to the fact that something happened. Okay? If you will see anything, you will also see an increase in firing rate. So increase in firing rate happens always here. There are other things that happen as well.
For the neuron, can you just describe, so one of these cochlear nucleus neurons has some background firing rate, and this is just the sound level at which you can statistically determine that it went above that.
Yeah. Yeah, so this was recorded by a program that does it automatically. Okay, the way that it does it is by starting it for reasons that I don't want to get into. It starts at high frequencies, and at each frequency, it starts at very loud levels. It presents a tone here and sees whether the number of spikes, 50 millisecond tone in this case, whether the number of spikes that were evoked is larger than what it expects by spontaneous rate. And if it's not, then if it is, then it goes down in level slowly until it stops detecting an increase in firing rate. And it does a little bit of going up and down until it's true, and then it stops and goes to the next frequency. Okay? Now, in peripheral neurons, again, this is easy and it can be done this way. In central neurons, it cannot be done in the same way. Okay, here the spontaneous rate, this neuron has a spontaneous rate of 60 spikes per second. And it's relatively 60 spikes per second. Okay, so I said that you have always an increase in firing rate. Now the question is what what happens. Yeah. There is a dynamic range. No, there is a dynamic range. Usually it's relatively small. So you see here a dynamic range of something like 60 dB in this plot, from 10 dB SPL to 70 dB SPL. This is very close to hearing threshold. Okay, this level, hearing threshold is 0 dB SPL. Okay, so 10 dB SPL is very close to hearing threshold. It's a unit, so this is what I'm trying to explain. 10 dB SPL is very close to hearing threshold. These are very weak sounds. Okay, 70 dB SPL is shouting. Okay, 100 dB SPL would be pain threshold. Okay, so this is, in terms of energy, it's a, in terms of energy, we have here a range of 60 dB, which is very large. Okay, in terms of spike rate, this neuron will usually increase its firing rate over a range of something like 20 to 30 dB and then saturate. Okay, so it will not show additional increase in firing rate as you go further up. But as I said, there may be other things that are happening. For example, if you test it at this range of low frequencies, of lower frequencies, you might see phase locking. You might see that the spikes start to lock to happen at a fixed phase of your sine wave, your tone. Yes.
Sorry, by 20 dB in spike in firing rate, do you mean a factor of 100 or a factor?
It's a factor of 20 dB. It's always in energy wise. So 20 dB is in energy. In terms of amplitude, it's
in terms of firing rate.
No, no, no. This is 20 dB in terms of sound level. No, in sound level. So it will go from 60 to 200 spikes per second. Okay, from 60 spikes per second to 200 spikes per second over a range of 20 to 30 dB in sound level. Okay. This is a contour line of a fixed increase in firing rate relative to threshold. Exactly. Relative to spontaneous, yes. Okay, so we call the center of this range the best frequency of the neuron. This is like the center of its tuning curve. And in fact, these neurons at the periphery are pretty well described by their tuning curve. You can understand quite a lot about the responses to other sounds when you know the tuning curve. So this is an example of a bird song. Okay, this is taken from a recording in the Smoky Mountains. This is how it sounds like. Now, we end. What?
That's Smoky in Tennessee, not Israel.
Yeah. I didn't record it. Sorry. You hear it? Okay, now you'll also hear me much better. Okay, this is a little bit, this is the original sampling rate. I will play it now at a slower sampling rate so that you can actually see, hear better what's happening. Okay, this is a spectrogram. You can hear the frequency going up and down and then up and down again, and you can actually hear it at a lower rate. Okay, so one thing you may have noticed is the fact that hearing a bird song at a lower rate sounds like the call of a different, larger bird. What? What do you say? Well, if you would take, if you would take a cat meow and play it slowly, it will sound like a cow. So we decided that the product of the sampling rate with the weight of the animal is constant. Anyway, now here is the tuning curve that I showed you before, presented along the same axis. So again, this is a spectrogram. So this is frequency and this is time. Here's the tuning curve of the neuron. When I presented this sound to this neuron, this is the response that I got. Okay, now this is the peristimulus time histogram. Sound started here. I will turn it. Sound onset was here, and the total length of this segment is about 100 milliseconds. And you see that the neurons tended to respond in three bursts. And in fact, you can pretty well predict where this burst should be by looking at the time in which the frequency trajectory crosses the tuning curve of the neuron. So this is the approximate level at which I presented the sound, and you can see that the first burst happened at the first time that the frequency trajectory entered the tuning curve, and the second burst occurred at the second traversal, and the third burst can be approximately correlated with the third traversal. Now, there's a lot of fine print here, of course, but the rough features of the responses can be easily predicted by using the tuning curve, which means, by the way, that these neurons at the periphery are relatively fast. I mean, they can follow these pretty fast tens of hertz changes in the temporal content of the sound within the tuning curve. So these are simple feature detectors. You have also complex feature detectors in the auditory system. In fact, this neuron was also recorded in the almost the first station of the auditory of the central auditory system. Now, here the stimuli are a little bit more complicated. They are noise bursts. Almost. I will show you later what I mean by almost. Okay. Here the stimuli are a little bit more complicated. So these are noise bursts. They are constructed in such a way that they are composed of two components. One of them is white noise, in which I cut a hole. I filtered out a hole in the middle, just above the best frequency of the neuron. So this is what we call the notch. Okay, the second component is a noise band that just fills this notch. I present the notch at a fixed level, and I change the level of the noise band in the middle. Okay, so what you end up is with a sound that looks like having a spectral valley at the best frequency when the noise band, the middle noise band, is at low levels, as a flat noise somewhere in the middle, and as a spectral peak when the level of the noise band is very high. Now, this is the response of this neuron. It's presented as a raster plot. So this is the rawest possible presentation of the data. Each line here is the response of the neuron to a single presentation. Each dot is the time of a single action potential. And the y-axis represents the level of the blue noise band. And what you see is that the firing rate, the spontaneous firing rate of this neuron is again relatively high. This class of neuron may reach 100, 200 spikes per second easily at the spontaneous rate. As when you present the sound, the neuron is inhibited both when it sees a spectral valley and when it sees a spectral peak. And it's slightly excited above background when it sees a flat noise. Okay, so this is relatively complicated operation. Okay, the neuron actually respond whenever it has some feature above its best some spectral feature above its best frequency. It's not really interested whether it's a valley or a peak, but it discriminates between interesting features and flat energy content above its best frequency.
So where is this norm again?
Okay. So here's the anatomy of the auditory system. We start with the hair cells and auditory nerve fibers. The first neuron that I showed you looks pretty much like an auditory nerve fiber. And then the auditory nerve fibers enter the central nervous system at the level of the cochlear nucleus. The second neuron that I showed you is in the cochlear nucleus. Okay, so it's the first station, it's really the first station of processing, but it's in a subdivision of the cochlear nucleus that already has some internal circuitry in it, so it's not a direct transformation of the background of the input. There's inhibition, there are clearly inhibition coming on from interneurons in this subdivision.
So the cell that you showed had sort of a to the non-changing response, it had sort of it had an off response, a decrease.
Yes.
In firing. So, and retinal ganglion cells have this kind of time derivative aspect to their response. Is that sort of a general lesson too? With the
I don't know.
Nucleus that they
no. What we know today, this was part of my postdoc study, is that this inhibition and this inhibition come from different mechanisms.
But then I'm looking at the okay. response.
So you are looking about this increase in firing rate.
And the decrease in the middle here.
Here.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is probably due to adaptation at the level of the synapse to transmitter depletion at the synapse. Okay? The inhibition here and the inhibition here are caused by two different mechanisms. This is glycinergic and this is GABAergic. And this is probably why there's the difference. Now, whether this is functionally significant, we don't know.
I don't know if I believe there's depletion from it. Maybe we don't want to dwell on this now, it's not for me, because I don't see the firing rate decreasing while the stimulus is on.
Here?
Yeah.
It does. I mean, if you do it, if you collect enough data, then you can show that the firing rate here is higher than the firing rate here. Anyway, the cochlear nucleus could be probably seen as an analog of the retina, but from there on, there's a huge amount of processing that's occurring below the level of the cortex and auditory system. Part of it is specialized, it's very specialized. For example, at the level of the superior olive, you have circuits that detect interoral time differences on the order of tens of microseconds. In birds, it's even below that, between information coming from the two ears. And then you have the inferior colliculus, which is a center that's totally absent. There is no analog to the inferior colliculus in the visual system. So at the cochlear nucleus, starting from the cochlear nucleus, you have specialized information streams that diverge. Each one of them, many of them, have a specific function. All of them converge at the level of the inferior colliculus. So the big complexity of the auditory system really starts at the level of the inferior colliculus, and then it goes through the thalamic station, the medial geniculate nucleus, into the auditory cortex. If you just count number of synapses, the inferior colliculus is as far from the hair cells as V1 is from the photoreceptors. So in terms of the amount of processing, you have at least two additional stations when you go from the inferior colliculus to the primary auditory cortex relative to the visual system. Yes? Yes. The inferior colliculus is an obligatory pathway on the way from the periphery to the auditory system, to the auditory cortex. This is not so for the superior colliculus in mammals. It has other differences too. I mean, the superior colliculus the external superior colliculus is visual, but the deep layers of the superior colliculus are much more oriented toward motor coordination, whereas the inferior colliculus, if at all, it's the opposite. It's the central core of the inferior colliculus that's the real auditory station, and around it, you have nuclei which have to do with feedback from the cortex down. In fact, the external nuclei of the inferior colliculus get huge cortical feedback, which must somehow also influence the streams coming upward, but we don't know much about it functionally. So there's a lot of additional processing going on in the auditory system that does not happen in the visual system on the way of the information from the periphery to the center. And so we might expect that coding of sound in the auditory cortex would be more complicated than in primary auditory cortex would be more complicated than in primary visual cortex. So what happens in the auditory cortex? What I want to show you now is what slowly becomes the standard model of neurons in auditory cortex. The idea is that the neurons have spectrotemporal receptive fields that are more complicated in structure than responses at the level of the visual of the auditory nerve, but the basic operation that is considered to be done by this neuron is still pretty much linear. So this is a spectrotemporal receptive field of a neuron. The way that you should read this is the following. This is time and this is frequency. Okay? At time zero, you should consider that a spike is occurring. And what you see before that is the frequency content of the stimulus that's necessary in order for this spike to occur. Okay? The way that this is computed is by presenting these were computed specifically. There are many ways of estimating the spectrotemporal receptive fields. The way these have been estimated specifically is by presenting 20 minutes of random chords. So you choose 7 frequencies out of a table of, let's say, 50 possible frequencies and present them for 20 milliseconds, and then you choose independently a different set and present it for 20 milliseconds and so on and so forth. And you look for each spike, you look at the chords that appear just before it and you average this set of chords. And this is what you see. And this is what you get at the end. So this is the same neuron tested in different ways. All the others are different neurons. And what you see are, in fact, the picture. This one is this neuron powered by tones. These two are two different ways of estimating the spectrotemporal receptive fields of this neuron. It was presented in a paper to show that the spectrotemporal receptive field is robust to the way that you estimate it. And then they presented additional examples. Now, what you see is that very often, in most neurons, you have some sort of central spot in which you need an excess energy relative to the background in order for the neuron to fire. But one thing that you see is a lot of inhibitory sidebands. So for this neuron to fire, it needs energy in this region, but it also prefers not to have energy just above and below this frequency. Yes. here. The spontaneous rate of these neurons is low. This is cortex. So it's very difficult to see inhibition if you don't have some kind of thing that would drive you upward. People tried to change the density of the cords, and there's some kind of optimal density at which you see the structure in the best way. Now, part of the problem in auditory cortex is these kind of nuisance parameters. For example, you suggest using a single tone and just changing it fast enough. In fact, this is not a bad stimulus for auditory cortex neurons. In the lab next door to us, there are people recording from awake monkeys. And they generated a sound which was based on a melody which was based on the simultaneous recordings of many neurons, where each time that a neuron fired, they put a tone at certain frequency, and then they tried to listen to it in order to find out about the patterns of spikes or things like that. We took such a sound and played it to a cat neuron, and it fired like crazy. I mean, it really liked it. And this was a sound of the kind of that you suggest. Okay, it's an almost random, not random, but almost random sequence of tones that appear at random times. But in order for this structure to appear, it turns out that you need an optimal density of cords. If you use too high density, then the structure it's difficult to see it anymore. If you don't use enough, then the inhibitory side bands disappear. So these are the kinds of nuisance parameters that you always have in auditory research that means that the system is not as simple as you would like it to be. But if you work within the middle range, then it's okay. Yes.
I realize it's not your data, but just to get some completeness. So in the first row, where you have sort of this chirp, you also see harmonic, at least the first harmonic.
This.
Yeah.
It's not harmonics. This is a logarithmic. This is a logarithmic axis. It's octaves relative to.
Sorry, I didn't read that.
Okay. It's not really harmonics. So they, I mean, the point of the paper here was to suggest that you have detectors, you have feature detectors in the auditory cortex. So they liked, for example, this neuron because it looked like it should respond well to downward going frequency modulated sweeps, or this neuron because it looked like it had some kind of edge, spectral edge detector. They did it a little bit. So in some neurons it worked and in some it didn't. It's not the full picture. Okay, what I want to show is actually an even better way of, an even better comparison. This is from a paper that's going to be published in Nature soon. This is a group that's interested in spatial processing, spatial sensitivity in the auditory system, the fact that we can tell sounds from the left from sounds from the right. And so what they do is to record responses of neurons in virtual space. This is in auditory cortex of ferrets, not of cats. And this is the kind of response of a neuron in primary auditory cortex of ferrets in virtual space. So the first they record in a very refined way the acoustics of the ears. They have a very good characterization of the acoustics of the ear, and then they present, they synthesize sounds that they present through earphones, and these sounds should be perceived by the ferret as coming from outside. This is the meaning of virtual space. And then they can record the activity of the neuron as function of the position of the sound in virtual space. And this neuron, for example, likes a lot sounds coming from the contralateral hemisphere. It responds much less to sounds coming from the ipsilateral hemisphere. Now they take the same neuron and they record with the same way that I showed you with random chords. They record its spectrotemporal receptive fields for the 2 ears. So you see that this neuron liked energy in 2 separate frequency bands in the contralateral ear, and at the same time you had to be a decreasing level in the ipsilateral ear. These are neurons that are called the excitatory inhibitory, EI neurons, pretty common in the auditory cortex. But you can take this detailed way and now use them to predict the response of this neuron based on the spectral structure of the stimuli that have been presented. Okay, so you know what you presented to the neuron because you presented it through earphones. You can take the actual spectrum that you presented, convolve it mathematically, I mean the actual operation of convolution, with the spectrotemporal receptive fields and get the predicted firing rate of the neuron. And if you just count spikes, you get, this is the predicted receptive field of the neuron based on its spectrotemporal receptive field, and this is the measured receptive field in space of the neuron, and they look pretty similar. Okay, so this, in this sense, the spectrotemporal receptive fields are predictive. I mean, you can tell how the neuron would respond to other sounds based on them, at least sometimes. Okay, this is an example of neuron in which the prediction was not so good. So, as always in auditory cortex, you have examples of everything. One thing that I would like to remark is that most of the receptive fields that you see in the ferret cortex are actually relatively simple. Okay? You have a spot of excitation with some inhibition around it, and they don't look like the ones that were published in the paper of the charms, which were taken in the monkey. I don't know if this is because the charms and Mersnick tried to push forward the idea of complex cells, and in fact most of the cells were simple, like in this study, or whether it's because monkeys are different from ferrets. Yeah. Yeah, so they actually tested it. I can show you, I have this, yeah, it's here. No, what did I want to do? This. No? Wait, I have it somewhere. Yeah. Okay, so this is the neuron with the FM. So they actually tested it. These are the stimuli that used to test it. So they consist of a chirp that rises that continuously rises. Okay, so you have a component that rises, and when it ends, it starts again and rises again. So you have simultaneously 4 or 5 things that go together. And this is the response of the neuron to these sounds. Now, this is the rate that corresponds to the slope of the line in the spectrotemporal receptive fields of the neuron. Okay, and they were very happy to show that it really responded best to FM chirps that went down at the appropriate rate. There's again fine print here. The fine print is that what happens here is that you see that the response appears as sharply, tightly locked spikes. This is in fact the time when the downward sweep hits the central spot of the receptive field of the neuron. So you have one response, and when the next tone that comes from above hits it, you have the second one, and then when the third one hits it, you have the third one, and so on. If you look at the single, okay, just at a single response like this, it turns out that the best response comes from a somewhat different rate. Okay, so if you just look at a single sound that goes down, a single chirp that goes down here, like this, then actually the best response occurs at a slightly lower rate. What happens is that in this case, the response occurred again and again and again, very regularly, which it didn't in this case. This is why the total spike count in response to this stimulus was higher. But this is a pretty good example, yes. They have a few like this.
Yeah. What are the numbers of the episodes?
Here?
Is that time in
these are the time in second, yes. This is 1 second. Yes. The spike per second, I can't see it myself.
One bigger
point. But yeah, I can't read it. But you can see that the response here, for example, was very precise. So at each sweep, each repetition, you got one spike per one, at least one spike. Here? No, here you have one. Two, three. It missed the fourth one, and then it had an offset response.
So they were
on
three lines.
On three, yeah. So you had you. It missed one. It missed the last one.
I think means she's asking on a given
trial.
No, on a given trial, you have spikes on all three lines. No, these are spikes. These are actually spikes.
I think.
This line are actually dots of the raster which are glued together.
Ah, so these are
okay.
Real spikes.
These are real spikes,
so
yeah.
No,
no, I didn't put them. It's the neuron that puts them. Yes. Yeah.
But why did they choose such a different number of
why? Because yeah, I mean, that's they wanted to have chirps, and they wanted the chirps to be as close as possible to the random codes. Okay, so they wanted to have multiple frequencies active at the same time. And the natural way of doing it was to put multiple chirps coming down. I mean, this sounds extremely unnatural in terms of these are not harmonics. Okay, they are equally separated on a logarithmic frequency axis. So this really sounds like alarms, four different alarms coming out at the same time, or something like that. It's I can't tell you. I mean, the result is that using these stimuli, they made the point that at least this specific neuron responded like you would expect from its spectral structure. Okay. Okay. Going back to this, so sometimes you get good predictions of the responses to virtual space. Sometimes you don't. But most time you do. Okay, this is why this is these are correlation coefficients between predicted and measured responses, and most of the correlation coefficients are pretty high. 0.7 would be considered as a very nice prediction in auditory cortex. So this way the spectrotemporal receptive fields is a very good predictor descriptor of the responses of these neurons to these sound bursts. The point is that these sound bursts are still relatively simple stimuli. They're just white noise presented from different locations in space. But in fact, the auditory world is much more complicated than that. Okay, here's an example of a real sound that you need to process. Ha, ha, ha. Anyone recognize this? Except for those already. Yeah. It's the beginning of the fifth symphony. This is a waveform, and this is a spectrogram. Okay, now the question. The question is, what did you hear?
Right?
Mahler. Okay. That's an object. What did you hear in Mahler?
Horns.
Horns. A trumpet. Did you hear the orchestra? You heard probably an orchestra playing. Okay, and also drums rolling and things like that. I mean, when we hear sounds, we don't hear frequencies. We don't hear. We don't hear temporal structure. What we hear are objects. Okay, we tend at the highest perceptual level, we interpret as in vision. Okay, we don't see lines, we see objects. The same way in audition, we don't hear frequencies, we hear objects. So you heard the trumpet. Okay, now these are harmonics. Okay, here the frequency axis is linear. So you can see pretty nicely the harmonic structure of the trumpet when it plays solo. Here's the orchestra came in. Okay? And you have a total spectral smear. Here it's the drums rolling. You have again the trumpet playing over drums rolling. You have again the trumpet sound, you can see it, the harmonic structure, but the drums rolling is again a total spectral smear. Okay, looking at the spectrogram, it's very difficult to say that here you had trumpets and here you had horns, that here you had the whole orchestra playing and here you had just the drums. Yes. Okay. Right. Right. Yeah. But this. Yeah. Great. But the spectrotemporal receptive fields of the cortical neurons, if it really does the convolution operation that I told you, that matches the spectral structure, the preferred spectral structure of the neuron with this, this is what it looks at. Okay. So you are right. I mean, I don't know what the basis vectors are. If I would have known it, okay, life would be much easier in terms of the way that we work in auditory cortex. Here, the basis vectors, if, as you call them, are frequencies. Okay, this is a spectrogram, so it's a time frequency representation. Okay, this is. Obviously not the thing that happens. I mean, this is what happens at the periphery. Okay, I showed you that this is sufficient in order to know this plus the receptive field of the neuron is sufficient to predict rather nicely what happens at the level of the auditory nerve. But perceptually, okay, there's much more that's happening here beyond the spectrotemporal analysis. Now, if you believe that neurons in auditory cortex do spectrotemporal analysis the way that I showed it before, then this is the relevant representation. Okay, so what I will try to show is that in fact they do much more. Okay, what I will try to show you, the data that we have, and we have now three different ways of showing it, that neurons in primary auditory cortex actually do much more than just this kind of spectrotemporal processing, matching. And very often they would respond to in mixtures. I mean, the crucial thing that I will that happens in the stimuli that we use is that we use mixtures. Okay, we use mixtures, and when we use a mixture, we see the complexity of the processing in primary auditory cortex. Very often in the mixture, they would respond to the weak components rather than to the strong components. And this happens in natural settings, and I don't know how to define natural. I mean, there must be some kind of physical description. I believe that the neurons do not know that they hear natural sounds. They know just that they hear sounds. Okay, so there must be something in the properties of the natural sounds that drive this special process. But I don't know what it is. And we interpret this finding as the idea that the neurons perform auditory source separation. Okay, they can already, they already do some part, at least some part of the process of taking the whole auditory scene and separating it into components. If you test them with simple scenes, then you get simple answers. It's when you test them with combination, with complex scenes, that you can really see how complex, how complicated the processing that they can do is really is. And finally, the result that I will show cannot be explained by this kind of matching, spectrotemporal matching process.
The enemy summation models, you just mean this linear response model.
Yes, this linear spectrotemporal summation.
On the log, on the logarithm.
On?
That was sort of linear response using the logarithm of the response before.
Using the log. The frequency, I mean, the axes in auditory system are always logarithmic. Both the level axis is logarithmic and the frequency axis tend to be logarithmic. But people try to estimate the same things on linear scales and they get very similar answers. The reason is that these spectrotemporal models are always perturbative. And as long as the perturbations are small, it doesn't matter whether you use log or linear scales. Okay. So here's again the bird song that I showed you before. The main procedure that we did here was to take a chirp, bird chirp that we recorded from natural, from that was.
Can I just ask you something about
yes.
natural?
Yes.
Very popular. So, you know, it's true that the horn in Mahler's fifth went up to the, at least as far as your figures show, the 27th harmonic. Is there anything in nature that I go out into the forest, take my microphone out, give a big grant, go to Bali, take my microphone out, and actually see harmonic structures?
It's an excellent question. The answer is to some extent, as always. I mean, bird songs, I mean, Michael will
right.
tell you more about it. I mean, the zebra finches have high frequencies, yeah. Cat meows, too, have relatively high harmonics. The problem is the fact that the sound propagation in air depends on frequency, and higher frequencies get absorbed much more than lower frequencies. So if you record at a distance of 100 meters from an animal, you won't see anything above 10 kilohertz. Okay. Everything else was already absorbed. This is probably why bats use very high frequencies for echolocation at a distance of a few meters. Okay, there's essentially no natural noise at these frequencies. Okay, so part of the answer is that the best recordings from nature that we have are always kind of low past, such that above 10, 15 kilohertz, there's nothing. Okay. Cats hear up to 50 kilohertz, and this is probably because they work at much closer distance to the range to the mouse, and mice and the rats, rodents vocalize at very high frequencies. Okay, so it really depends on the exact context in which you're talking. Now, many animal vocalizations are harmonic, but many are not. Okay, many are sort of narrow band noise bands, which are all over the place. Okay, these birds, for example, that we used here have a relatively pure slowly modulated sign type of song. There is a little bit of high harmonic, you can see it here, but it's extremely low. It's almost 60 dB below the main. There's no chance that a bird will hear it, that another bird will hear it. Okay, so this is a natural chirp. Oh. Put it at the middle, sort of. Okay, so you can hear the frequency going up and then slightly down. Now, this is a natural recording from the spectrogram. You can see that it's not just the pure tone. Okay, in addition to the pure tone, you have here echoes. This bluish, this yellowish thing here is echo. Okay, yes.
That's recording from how far away?
It's probably tens of meters away. It's probably tens of meters away. Okay, that's a field recording. It was non-specific. We asked here for soundscapes. Okay, so they just put the microphone out and recorded everything that that they had. This is echoes. You can see that energy in these frequencies appear here only after it appeared in the main chirp. Okay, so these are echoes, and you have some kind of background here that's partially real and partially machine noise. Okay, microphones and field tape recorders don't have a large dynamic range. So what we did was to separate the main chirp from the natural chirp. The main, just the frequency modulated, amplitude modulated tone by itself from the natural chirp. We did it by using taking short frames, computing frequency, Fourier transform, estimating the amplitude and phase at the maximum, and then moving one sample and repeating the same thing. And then we just resynthesized the main chirp, amplitude and its amplitude and phase sample by sample. And when you do it, you can subtract the main chirp from the natural chirp sample by sample and get the noise, everything that was left. Okay, and this is how they sound. Okay, so this is the natural chirp. The main. Okay, they are pretty similar to each other. Can you hear the difference?
Yes. It sounds like you have some roughness.
Yes, the roughness, exactly. The roughness is the noise. Okay, this is what's left, the leftover. Okay, but
actually, that sounds, the noise sounds much more like echoes than it does like background noise.
Yeah, the echoes are the dominant components of this. You can see it's just by the color. Okay? Most of the noise is echo. And the echoes here are between 15 and 20 dB below the main sound in these recordings.
What?
What?
Echo.
What? This is from the mountains. No, you have echoes everywhere. Here you have also echoes. In this room you have a lot of echoes. I mean, this is why you have this heavy carpet on the floor. In open fields, you have less echoes than in a room, but still everything is that. Remember that the wavelength at 1 kilohertz, wavelength is 30 centimeters. So essentially everything is large enough to any plant, any tree, any. A piece of wood is large enough to reflect. Okay, so everything is sends back echoes. You have echoes from everywhere. Now, these are the responses. So you will have echoes from the ground. Yeah, I mean, you have at least the ground. What? What did you say?
In space.
Yeah. In space you don't have air. You don't have air. What you can try is to hang by a very thin wire from a very from a helicopter or something like that. And what? Or to put a microphone on a bird. That's anyway, these are the responses of a neuron in the cochlear nucleus to the three sounds. Okay, one typical thing that we see in the cochlear nucleus is the fact that the neurons tend to respond in the same way to the natural chirp and to the main chirp, provided that their best frequency is within the range of frequencies covered by the main chirp, as long as the neurons are sensitive to the frequency range in which the main chirp appear, then the responses to the main chirp and to the natural chirp will be similar. And in this case, the response to the noise by itself has a different temporal pattern. Although the total number of spikes evoked here, here, and here is not very different. Now, these are the responses in auditory cortex to the same stimuli. These are four neurons. Each column is a neuron. And here I have a somewhat fuller representation of the tonal receptive fields, to answer your question from before. So again, we have the axes are frequency and level. The response is shown as a spike rate. You should really consider it as spike counts. These neurons tend to respond by a single spike or two spikes to each tone representation. This spike is locked to the onset of the sound. It appears 10 to 20 milliseconds after the onset of the sound. So we can count these spikes. And you get these kind of narrowly tuned receptive fields in cortex. Some of them have internal structure. Again, answering your question from before, this neuron, for example, appears like it has a fine structure within its frequency response field. So just plotting the outline, which would be the threshold tuning curve, would be reducing the data by far too much. Yeah, but these are the frequency responses, and we tended to record these neurons in a region that where the best frequencies are within the range of the bird chirps. Okay, the bird chirps are centered at 4 kilohertz, and what we did was to try to record the neurons with best frequencies between 2-3 kilohertz and 7-8 kilohertz. So that the chirp is within the tuning curve. These are the responses to the two stimuli, to the main chirp and to the natural chirp of these neurons. And as you can see in these neurons, there's very large differences in the responses between the two stimuli. Now, these are extreme examples. They're chosen to be extreme examples. I will show you the statistics in a moment. But the interesting thing about these neurons is the fact that when we measure the responses to the noise by itself, okay, they responded to the noise as the same way that they responded to the natural sound. So it looked like, remember, the natural sound is a sample by sample sum of the noise and the main. Okay, it's a linear sum of these two stimuli. Now, in terms of frequency, in terms of spectral content, the main is the dominant stimulus. And the main, the power spectrum of the main is shown here in this black curve. It's within the tuning curve of these four neurons. Okay, they should have responded to it. Okay, but they don't. They should, in the combination, they should have responded to the combination as they respond to the main, because this is a dominant contribution to the energy of the stimulus within the tuning curve. Okay, but they don't. In the combination, they respond as if they heard the noise, the weaker component. Yes. This is a good question. I don't know. I think I will show you later responses to different kinds of noises. I think that the fact that the noise has a non-trivial spectrotemporal structure is important here. When I said that there is something in the natural quality of the stimuli that's important, this is part of it. Okay, the spectrotemporal structure of the noise is non-trivial, and it adds to this phenomena.
What is the time scale?
What? The pink thing is the power spectrum of the noise. Power spectrum. Okay, so if you look at this one, for example, the black line go into the tuning curve of the neuron. The pink line is actually below. Okay, they are both relatively narrow band. Okay, they should, I mean, when you present the sum of them, the dominant acoustic component within the tuning curve of the neuron is the black. Okay, but the neuron responds as if it heard the pink sound in the combination. Yes? Here? That's a very good question. I mean, one more formal line of analysis that we try to push is the fact that these neurons integrate the energy differently when the energy appears as a broadband stimulus and when the energy appears as a narrowband stimulus. If you just ask the following question, take a broadband noise, okay, present it to the neuron, see how strongly it responds. Okay? Now, take a pure tone with the same energy within the tuning curve at the best frequency and play it to the neuron and see how much it responds. And now compare the level of energy within the tuning curve of these two stimuli. Okay, very often it turns out that you need much less energy, wideband energy, than narrowband energy in order to drive the neuron at the same level. Okay, it looks as if when you present broadband sound like this, okay, the neuron really looks at a much wider frequency band than when you look at the narrow. Okay, so the black line is mostly pure tone. Okay, the color plots with pure tones. These are pure tones. Okay, these are frequency response areas. And they're measured with pure tones. Because you simply can't hold the neuron long enough to do everything on it. No, it's clear that we have now to start measuring, since the spectrotemporal characterization of these neurons become pretty standard now, one thing that we have to do is to start measuring these things. But the spectrotemporal receptive fields of neurons, again, are very often relatively simple. Okay, they will not be very different than a large spot, which is positioned at about the frequency of the best sensitivity of this. Okay, so I'm not afraid that the results will be very different. Okay, that's one thing. The other thing is that the details, again, the point here is not that the response is different for each sound separately. The point here is that you add a weak sound to a strong sound and you get the response to the weak sound. Now, no matter what the shape of the spectrotemporal receptive field is, this can't happen as long as its center sits within the center of the strong sound. And the strong sound is within its center.
So that statement is true for second order
It's true. I mean, it is, does not respond to the nature. It does not respond to the noise. Here you look, you see the temporal structure of the response. In these two, it's the time of the burst that is the same here and here and is different in the other one. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Okay, let me skip this. Okay, this is just the kind of quantification of the results. As I told you, in the when you look at the responses to the main and the natural in the periphery, and I will show you in a moment another figure showing this in lower stations, you get a relatively nice correlation between the responses, the strength of the responses. Okay, here we have this plot shows the normalized spike rate. So it's normalized between spontaneous at zero and the maximum response rate of each neuron at one. Okay, and you can see that the points just fill the whole space. Okay, there's almost no correlation between the responses to the two stimuli. The correlation coefficient 0.26 is significant because we have a lot of data, but it's not strong. And the question is then always whether this is the cortex that does it. Okay, so we have data from the inferior colliculus and from the MGB, and I think just to make the point, it's sufficient to look at the MGB data. These are the responses of one neuron in the thalamus, in the auditory thalamus, to three different triplets taken from three different bird chirps that we used, and you see that in this case, in every case, the response to the natural sound and the response to the main sound are essentially identical. Okay, it's the response to the noise in this case that's much that's different. In this case, this neuron did not like wideband stimuli at all, so it did not respond to the wideband stimulus to the noise when it was presented by itself. Yeah. The neurons in the MGB follow much better fast changes in spectrotemporal energy than neurons in auditory cortex. Okay, the auditory system becomes much more and more sluggish as you go higher up. The temporal bandwidth of auditory nerve fibers is about 1 kilohertz. Okay, when you get to the inferior colliculus, they follow at 100 hertz without any problem. Some of them go above. When you go to cortex, it's 10 hertz. Okay, the thalamus is somewhere in the middle. But the auditory system becomes much more sluggish as you go above. Okay, so we can stop here. I will continue. So we tried to do some, the thing that's very fashionable now, and to do some informational theoretic analysis of this data. So I want to go through it. The irresponsible what? The
irresponsible party for taking the logarithm and the logarithm of the data.
Okay, so we did it in a way that's pretty simple-minded. And once the first thing that we did was to compute the mutual information between the responses and the stimuli. Okay, so what we have is the bird song. We have 8 different 8 different songs. We usually use 4 of them in each experiment, and each one has multiple versions. There's the main, the natural, noise, there's an artificial version I didn't speak about. So we get something like in different experiments around 30 different stimuli that we present to the neuron. Now, what I show here is the distribution of spike counts, a histogram of the spike counts per single response along the x-axis, and the stimulus ID, just the stimulus ID number along the y-axis. The stimuli are arranged such that the largest mean spike count is for the stimuli up here, and the lowest mean spike count is for the stimuli here. Okay, now when you have a matrix like this, you can compute the mutual information. And this is a kind of a lower bound for the mutual information between the response and the activity of the neuron. Okay, we don't know what the mutual information is. We don't what in order to optimize the lower bound, we do 2 things. First of all, yes.
Yeah. Can you just back up here? What's along this axis here?
This is spike count. Okay, so this is a histogram. Along each line here is a histogram. Okay? In this case, the bean of the histogram was 5 spikes. So between 0 and 5 spikes, responses that had between 0 and 5 spikes were counted here. Between 5 and 10 spikes were counted here, and so on. Okay?
If you rotated it by 90 degrees, it would have been easier.
Okay. Yeah. That's fine. So each line is the histogram for one stimulus. Okay, when you would,
the stimuli, sorry, if you go across this way.
This way is the response, and this way is stimulus ID. So each line here is the histogram for one stimulus. Okay, we have 20 repetitions. This is one cell, yeah, and we have 20 repetitions per stimulus. So each line here, if you sum the total number of repetition in each line here, you should get 20.
And this is integrated over the whole stimulus.
Okay, so what we did here, by the way, this is work done with Gal Chechik and Tali Tishbi, of course, Jerusalem. Okay, so what Gal did here was to try to optimize the parameters of the analysis to get the largest possible mutual information. Since this is a lower bound, okay, he tried to get the best possible lower bound.
Why?
Yeah. Because we don't take into account here that it's spike count. Okay, so it goes through. You go through a data reduction step.
So greatest spikes in what interval?
What?
In what time interval?
So he varied the window, and the data that's shown here are with a window that's optimized for each neuron. Usually the window was something like 40-50 milliseconds after from sound onset.
And
what? This neuron, this was a neuron that fired a lot. I mean, this is why he used this. Yeah, I don't know what's the specific parameters of this one. Well,
this is cortical.
But this is an extreme example, yes. This is an extreme example. Yeah. 20 spikes. I don't know what's the window here, and I don't remember the raw data for this neuron. Okay, it's just this is just a methodological. Yes.
What are the other 29?
They are similar to these, taken from different segments of birdsong. Okay, we have in this case, in this experiment, we had 4 stimuli. Okay, 8 versions of each. I mean, we started with 4 bird songs and we generated 8 versions for each bird song. Slightly different versions.
But this sound has a, as you showed in the previous slide, it has a completely different tempo response to these stimuli.
Right.
So you're completely ignoring
it. At the moment, I'm ignoring it completely. I'll show you later another type of analysis that we did where we tried to take into account the relationship between the spikes and the sound. Okay, but here, the only thing that, the only parameter of the sound that appears is its identification number. Okay, I completely forget everything about the dynamics, the spectral structure, the anything. Okay, and the only thing that appears in the, with respect to the response is a spike count. Okay, so there's a lot of data reduction here. Okay, but once I have this, I can compute the mutual information. The other thing that we did here was always to subtract the estimated mutual information under the hypothesis of independence. Okay. Now, if there's no correlation, if there's no what? By shuffling, yes, by shuffling. Between stimulus and response, okay? We just shuffled the whole count and computed the. We actually shuffled. We did. It could be done easy. What? I think there are 10 averages here for each. It's actually our experience is that with this data, the bias term is pretty stable. You don't need to do a lot of shuffling to get a reasonable estimate. It's usually something like between 10 and 20% of the mutual information. If there is, I mean, in a case like this. Okay.
Yeah. So
we shuffle.
Data, you fix a probability so you know the two underlying information, and then generate spikes according to that, and we're gonna shuffle and see if we really get the right.
Well, we shuffled the original data between stimuli.
The point is,
yes.
You don't know what the true mutual information. Right?
Yes.
But you can start where you generate the probability yourself, so you know really what the true mutual information is. Then from those probabilities, you generate circuit data.
Okay.
The mutual information, you shuffle these cracks. See if your algorithm actually does a good job predicting
the environment. Yeah.
Did you do that?
No, that's a good idea.
Because I usually know, otherwise you would have mentioned
it. Okay, anyway. Let me skip this for a moment. Okay? The point. These are the numbers that we get for the mutual information in recordings in primary auditory cortex, in the thalamus, in inferior colliculus, and from a model of auditory nerve fibers. Okay, we did not record the responses from auditory nerve fibers, but we have a model that's considered as a reasonable model for auditory nerve fibers. And the black things should be considered as a good baseline comparison. The point that I want to make is we have about 32 stimuli here. Gal, the student who did it, is put log and log, not log 2 in his MATLAB programs, so all the numbers are given in nuts and not in bits. In such a way it's what? Yeah, it's nuts are larger than bits.
Nuts are larger than bits.
Larger than bits, yes. So 3 point, I mean, it's 32 stimuli, it should saturate here at 3 point something knots. Not at, it would saturate at
right,
5 bits.
If you want to get pitch, you divide by 0.7.
Yes. Okay. If you want bits, knots, to go from knots, if you have the number in knots, multiply it by about 70%, you will get the number in bits. No, you should divide, no, you should divide by 0.7. If you, yes. Yeah. If you have the number in bits, you should take 70% of it and you will get the number of knots.
Okay.
This is histograms over different neurons. Yeah.
The data set again is this one stimulus to sort of one bird song.
No, again, we have four bird songs like this that we use, between 4 and 8, and we have between 4 and 8 different versions of it. So we have a total of something like 32 stimuli, in this, between 20 and 30 stimuli for each neuron that we test.
For each version, you mean also the main noise?
Main noise, artificial, there are versions that I didn't show you here.
I guess what I understand is the stimuli subsets are not uniform.
No, they are not.
Okay.
But they are very similar to each other. They're all bird songs, they're all single modulated frequency type of main stimulus plus noise. So it's in terms of, if you want, it's a hard discrimination task for a neuron, in the sense that the stimuli are relatively similar to each other. There's nothing, I agree with you, I mean, it's, We don't. It's just for this specific data set. I'm not claiming anything more.
There
is, but in the cortex. I mean, the point is that you have about, on the average, something like half a bit, half a knot. Okay. Mutual information between the stimuli and the. The response at the auditory nerve fibers and the inferior colliculus, and you get about half of that, 1/4, okay, 0.25 knot mutual information in the cortex and the IC. So there's a little bit, about a factor of 2 reduction in the mutual information when you go from the lower stations to the higher stations. What? Much more, yes. In terms of number of neurons in inferior colliculus, you're talking about 10 to the fifth neurons in the main nuclei. In the thalamus, it's about probably an order of magnitude larger, and in the cortex is another order of magnitude larger. Okay, so you have sufficient number of neurons to now, what we tried to do, the Fahrenheit goes down. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, but you don't really know. I mean, because you don't. I mean, you don't really know that the noise is uncorrelated in all this order of magnitude more so. I mean, that's something.
I don't know.
So right now.
I don't know. These are very rough.
This is potentially paradoxical right now, right? This data.
I will show in a moment. I mean, this is a minor effect compared to what I will show next. Okay? Yes.
So this is average for all the stimuli. Is there a subset of stimuli about which the cortex does very well?
No.
Nobody out there, right?
No, I guess.
And this is not an average.
Yeah, so I mean, this is again. No, again, these are always lower bound. We try to optimize them as much as we can, but we didn't try to use, for example, the type of expansion of Panzerian Treves to take into account also the PST shape and the correlation, all of these things. We didn't try to do these things, so this should be taken as the roughest possible approach to the data. Okay, but again, this is the baseline. The interesting stuff comes, I think, next. Yeah. So the next thing we tried to do is to look at what happens if we look at more than one one neuron. Now here we have a problem. In principle, in order to look at more than one neuron, the set of neurons should be measured simultaneously. Okay? Agree? We have many more pairs of neurons if we take neurons that were not recorded simultaneously. So what Gal did here was to look at neurons that are conditionally independent given the stimulus. Okay, if you take two neurons that were not recorded simultaneously, you can create a joint distribution if you assume that they are independent given the stimulus, and then compute the mutual information there.
Okay.
What? You don't know if it's a lower bound or not, and the reason, okay, so here's the, what we are really interested is in kind of a redundancy synergy measure that would be the mutual information between the joint distribution of all cells and the stimulus, minus what you would get from by summing the mutual information of each cell alone. Okay, this turns out to be equal to the difference between two terms. One of them is the conditional mutual information between the cells, multi-information between the cells given the stimulus, and the other one is the unconditioned multi-information between the neurons. What? These are multi-information. It's average of log combined information divided by the product of the marginals. Times log okay, this is the multi information. So
the first term you have all the
what?
So the first term you do is the
conditioned on S and then averaging all over all the stimuli. Okay, that's the meaning of the first term. And the second term is the unconditioned thing. Okay, now if you take conditionally independent neurons, this is zero. So what you end up is just with a number that's always negative. Okay, so for conditionally independent neurons, you will always get either non-redundancy, either independence or redundancy using this term. And the question is whether this is a lower bound or not depends on the behavior of this thing. And this thing you can estimate only for neurons that were recorded simultaneously. Okay? We don't know. We started looking at it. We have a relatively small amount of data for neurons that were measured at the same time. It looks like that when you do it for neurons that respond simultaneously, this term becomes more negative than it was, and this is slightly positive, so the difference between them is actually independent of the assumption. It's the same whether you assume independence or not. Okay? So it looks like, I mean, from the preliminary analysis that Gal did in the last few weeks, it looks like what I will show you is the right answer also when you take simultaneously recorded neurons and do not make the assumption of conditional independence. Yes.
So why are you interested in this particular quantity? What's it tell you?
It will tell you, well, the it in a moment, it tells you something about what the neurons it tells you about the way that the similarity between the ways that the neurons look at the stimulus. Okay, it tells you to what extent two neurons look at the stimulus in the same way. Okay, if the responses are similar to similar stimuli, okay, this number.
Similar, you say you just number your stimuli.
Yeah.
There's no
No, the similarity comes from the distribution of spike counts. Okay, if the distribution of spike counts, these two matrices will be similar, okay, you will have high redundancy. If the matrices are different, when you use the same a number of your stimuli, then you will get independence. Okay, so yes, so it tells you how similar are the histograms for the two neurons, or for the triplet, we went to triplets of neurons. Okay, it tells you to what extent the neurons really think that the neurons respond in the same way to the same stimuli. Now, why should neurons respond the same way to the same stimulus? For example, if they have the same spectrotemporal receptive field, okay? Not directly, but in a moment you will see that it's indirectly we come up with a strong result here.
You're going to show us some real data, not the stuff in a moment.
No, this is.
Why don't you go on?
Okay. Anyway, when we compute the redundancy, it turns out that when you look at A1 and MGB, the higher stations, you have much less redundancy in these terms than when you look at the inferior colliculus and the auditory nerve fiber. This is between pairs of neurons. So it tends to tell you that neurons in the MGB and the cortex, okay, tends to look differently at the same stimuli. Okay, the effect is even stronger if you look at triplets. Okay, if you look at triplets of neurons, there's very little redundancy in the MGB and A1. You have a lot of redundancy in the IC and ANF. So the question is, where is this redundancy coming from?
That means there's like a pattern of firing.
It means that if you look at two different neurons in the cortex, yes, or the way that if you choose a stimulus and they respond to the same way to the stimulus, if you look at two neurons in the cortex, okay, and you know that they respond in the same way to one stimulus, it doesn't tell you anything about how they will respond to a different stimulus from this set. Okay? Whereas in the IC and ANF, it does tell you that if they respond the same way to one stimulus, they will tend to respond the same way to another stimulus too. Okay? Now,
For this set.
For this set. Now, where does this come from? It comes from the fact that neurons have a best frequency. Okay, why should there be a high redundancy in the auditory nerve fibers data? It's because a neuron that's sensitive, auditory nerve fibers that's sensitive at 4 kilohertz and an auditory nerve fiber that's sensitive at 4.5 kilohertz really look pretty much at the same physics. Okay, they filter their stimuli through this narrow receptive field. They will end up with the same type of responses as I showed you before. I mean, in the auditory nerve fiber. So, two neurons with similar BFs. Okay, I didn't explain what I showed. This is redundancy as a function of the best frequency of the pairs of neurons. Okay, so in auditory nerve fibers, you see that auditory nerve fibers that have the same best frequency tend to have high redundancy. Auditory nerve fibers that have best frequencies that are far apart tend to not to be redundant in this sense, in the sense that they respond in the same way to the same stimuli. Okay, so this is the picture in the auditory nerve fiber simulation. This is the picture in the cortex. So again, in the cortex, if you take two neurons that have the same best frequency, same shape of frequency response area, okay, they should the same type of responses to pure tones, they will respond to this set in completely different ways. Same best frequency, okay. We don't know again, because most of these pairs are actually recorded in different animals.
Okay. I understand you sort of quantify the effects you described before, but you picked a data set that focused on something that had sort of constant output and just shifted its frequency. But when you showed us even the spectrogram of Mahler's fifth or I mean, the thing that hits you is not just that you have a frequency that stays relatively constant, but the transitions. And are you going to, do you have any idea how this, what this analysis would give you if include the transitions?
No. We didn't do it, so I don't know. My guess is that if you put strong transitions into your stimuli, then you would tend, the neurons will tend to respond in the transition points. Auditory cortex neurons will tend to respond to transition points. So you will enhance the similarity between them, because at transition points, all of them will respond.
Right. Okay. There's also a point where you start to see these adaptation effects. I wonder if you just get a completely different view of A1. I mean, this is one sort of a CW view.
Well, these stimuli are already much more complicated than pure tones or steady noise bursts. They have already a non-trivial spectrotemporal structure. Okay, so this is just a scatter plot of the same data, the redundancies as function of the frequency separation between the two neurons. This is for the auditory nerve fiber simulation, and this is for the inferior colliculus data, MGB and cortex. So it looks like the neurons start to respond very differently. Neurons which have similar pure tone responses start to respond very differently to these stimuli. Now, this is a quantification, if you want, of the fact that the response of the neuron does not depend directly on the spectrotemporal structure of the sound anymore. Now, another way of seeing the same thing is to compute a different kind of mutual information. Here we tried to compute mutual information between single spikes and the preceding acoustic segment. So what we did was to first take these sounds. This is an example of one of these chirps. We took all of them, all 30-something stimuli, and we separated it, made them into frames of 50 milliseconds and then clustered the frames. So we had 32 representative frames. This was done in order to reduce the dimensionality of the acoustic input. Okay, so this was a kind of a pre-processing stage. Afterwards, when we did it many times so that the results will not depend on the specific clusterization that we chose. And, okay, I don't have the slide here. And then we computed the mutual information between this set of representatives and the spikes that occurred at the end of each one of these frames. And in this case, what we did was to take the distribution. So we had the frames, this was the stimulus, and the responses were the binary words composed of the response of multiple neurons. Okay, so we could test this for two neurons, three neurons, four neurons, take more and more neurons. And again, this was done assuming conditional independence.
So every time there's a spike, you look at what you see when you divide it into categories, right?
Yes. So we first take all of the acoustics and categorize it. Next, for a single neuron, we will take each, we have now a histogram that has 32 possible stimuli and two possible responses, spike or non-spike. Okay? For pairs of neurons, we'll have 32 by 4. For 16 neurons, we'll have 32 by 65,000 something binary words. Okay, these are the histograms from which we compute the mutual information. Okay? And now we can do it as function of the number of cells that, and This is the data for the inferior colliculus. This is the data for the MGB, and this is the data for the cortex. Now here, there's a reduction of almost a factor of 10 in the amount of information when you go from cortex, when you go from inferior colliculus to cortex. Okay, the cortex, spikes in the cortex don't tell you much about the exact physics, about the exact spectrotemporal structure that occurred just before them. Yeah.
But in the whole set that you looked at, this neuron never happened to spike. Right? So then your answer would still be zero.
So this has to be normalized by the total number of spikes. But it is, by the way that you construct it, it's normalized by the total number of spikes. This is mutual information per is it per spike or not? No, it's per unit time. I have to check it. Well, the difference in firing rate is not a factor of 10. Okay. It may be a factor of 2 or 3, but it's not a factor of 10. Okay.
But
you're right.
Anyway, the difference should be less.
Probably. Okay. But then there's the other thing that we see. If you now normalize to the a single neuron information. Okay, assume that neurons were independent. In that case, your points, as you add more and more neurons, should fall on this diagonal line. Okay, so now I normalized something. Okay? Here I assume conditional independence too. It's independence with the stimulus, yes. Yes, total independence.
But again, that also assumes that there is a good number on stimuli. Otherwise, if they are building independent neurons, it's still get.
Yeah, again, this is limited to the data set that I'm looking at. I don't know how to generalize it from the data set that they have to all possible stimuli. Okay, I'm not making any statement about anything beyond the data set I used to test these neurons.
But the information should separate anyway.
Of course it should saturate. The point is that the size of the set that still looks like independent in the cortex is much larger than the size of sets that looks like independent in the IC. For this specific set. It will saturate in the cortex too.
Again, that could be because the cells in the cortex individually carry much less information.
Yes.
Right. So if probably if you already
yeah, but you can't hold the sticks by both hands. Either they don't carry much information, in which case, yeah, the two things go together, of course. The fact that they have much less information about the stimulus and the fact that they look like they are much more independent, okay, probably is related to each other. Yeah, I agree. But the point of this analysis is that there's much less information about the actual physics of the sound when you are in cortex than when you are in IC. Okay, of course, the little amount of information you have about the physics of the sound then sums up approximately linearly for small sets of neurons. Okay. Yes.
When you point out that saturation could be due to the fact that you only share 30 stimuli,
so it could very well be that if you instead of 4 or 32, you have 46 stimuli, that the saturation
will be lower.
Occur as a higher level.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, this is all
Yes.
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 So you're already getting to a third of that, and maybe you're seeing cells be completely independent, but you're seeing separation just due to the fact that.
But this just strengthens my point, because this is this for the red points. Okay, the point that I want to make is the difference for this specific set between the red and the blue. Okay, both are taken with the same stimuli.
Yeah, but okay. Our point is that
you use more stimuli, and the difference is made. Okay. I don't think so, because the reason for this difference is, again, is the fact that the neurons in the IC really look like they respond to the physics of the sound, whereas the neurons in the cortex, the fact that they can respond, you see, at this stage, okay, the main determinant of the class at which you will be is really the spectrotemporal structure. Okay, what I showed you in the raw data is a spectrotemporal structure is not a good determinant of the response of the auditory of the cortical neurons. Okay, and this expresses itself in the informational analysis. It's really quantification of this effect. Okay, the fact that you can have a strong sound and a weak sound, and another strong sound which is very similar, and the neuron will respond to very differently to all three of them. Okay, so what I really show here is a quantification of this feature of the raw data. So I don't think this will disappear.
Okay, but that's okay? Not independent evidence.
No, that's the underlying phenomenon.
I think there is a misconception here that there is an absolute redundancy. What you have in mind when you ask your question is that in some way there is a true thing that your data on the window, but there is not.
I agree.
Yeah.
You see, the problem that we have with the raw data is that we can show them, but then it becomes very difficult to. I wanted to quantify the fact that the neuron in cortex do not look at the physics of sound. Okay, or much less. Yeah, so what I have. Yeah, yes, but I want, I mean, these are examples. I want to put numbers.
No, there's no argument that you have to abstract it. I guess it's just, I don't know, I find it a little bothersome that it's such a selective example. You give an example of natural sound, and you give such an example of the kind of stimulus that you use. I mean, you give something that's kind of smooth.
You mean that?
Well, maybe, you know, I mean, maybe, not the heart of it, but maybe it's transient. I mean, you need to have a broader set to make a statement that it's not dependent on the physics of the sound.
Okay, so let's go to another example, okay? A very different set of sounds. I want to go relatively fast on the last two examples, okay? Because they go in the same direction, the fact that you can do very small perturbation of to sounds and get very different responses. Okay? So, let me skip the reason I did these experiments and just.
I think this is dangerous.
Okay. Wow.
What?
Okay, so the question is now is completely different. I mean, before what we had is a strong tonal component with weak noise, and ending the noise did strong stuff to the response to the main, to the strong tone. Here I'm going to do something that's opposite. I'll have strong noise and a weak tone. Okay, so it's a masking experiment. In a masking experiment, what you do is you try to you try to, you present the tone in noise and you change the level of the tone until you can't hear it anymore. Okay, so here is how it sounds like. Here is the noise. Well, you have to go through the... Noise, yes. Here's a tone. Okay, and when I add them together, you will start by hearing the tone within the noise, and then since the tone level goes down, it will disappear. Okay, did it disappear? Okay. Now, there's a phenomenon, there's a lot of study in the psychophysical literature about what happens if instead of just Gaussian noise, you use a Gaussian noise that is multiplied by a slowly varying envelope. Okay, so here's the Gaussian noise multiplied by a slowly varying envelope. This is a 10 hertz sine wave. Okay, it creates correlations between frequency bands. And this is how it sounds like. Now, well, in Jerusalem, we've been getting used to these sounds in the last year. And when you add a tone to this stimulus, you can hear it much better, even at very low levels. Okay, by itself this is not a big deal. Because all kinds of things. You have much less energy, you have about 3 dB less energy here. You have these short periods of off sound that you can use. The reason psychophysicists became interested in this phenomenon is because the threshold between the non-fluctuating noise band and fluctuating noise band, this difference actually increases as a function of bandwidth. So as you make the noise wider, more wideband, the ability to hear better within the noise becomes better. And this is a phenomenon that's interesting for many reasons. It certainly indicates some kind of central location for this processing. So what we tried to do is to look for a neural correlate of this phenomenon. So here are the responses of an auditory cortex neuron to the stimuli. Wide band noise, narrow band noise. And here we have modulated noise and unmodulated noise. Okay, for unmodulated noise, the neurons will respond at onset with a short burst, usually one or two spikes. And then, in this case, this neuron doesn't respond anymore. Other neurons will fire at a steady, low firing rate. Okay, when the noise band is modulated, the neurons will tend to follow the modulation waveform, the slow envelope of the modulator, but the envelope locking is better when the bandwidth of the noise is larger. Okay, so the neurons respond much better to a modulated noise, to wideband modulated noise than to an unmodulated noise. And the effect here is that when you add a low-level tone, and in a moment I will show you how low is low-level, a low-level tone tends to suppress the ability of the neuron to follow the envelope of the masker. Okay? Here I'm talking about a tone that 20-30 dB below the energy of the noise within the tuning curve of the neuron. Okay, so it's again a case in which the addition of a very low level tone changes quite strongly the response of the neuron to the yeah.
Is this where tone is continuous?
The tone is continuous.
No, but is the tone in the near the best frequency?
Yes, yes.
It only works if it's near?
It works when it's near. Yeah, you need to have a response to the tone in order for this to occur. Yes. Okay. This is time, and this is tone level. Now, this is wideband, and this is the narrowest middle and wideband noise bands. And what you see is that in these plots, the lowest level that I show here is close to the hearing threshold. I don't have here the tone alone responses. In the next slide, I'll have it. Yes.
I'm a little confused because earlier you showed us that most cortical cells don't respond well to your frequency of tone.
They respond with a single spike.
Single spike.
Yeah, at onset, yes.
Okay. So that's the consistency.
This is the same thing here. Okay, at very low levels, you see the response to the noise. In this case, the noise was evoked activity at each one of its phases. Okay, so you see the onset response, second and third peak. Okay, when the tone is at very high levels, you see just the response to the tone alone. So you see just the onset response to the tone here. Okay?
So the tone and noise were
in this case, they were gated together, yes. In this case, they were gated together. Okay? So the largest difference between the response to noise alone and very low level tones plus noise and the responses to higher level tones plus noise, okay, the largest contrast between noise alone and noise plus tone occurs here. Okay? This is where it's easiest to say that you added a tone to the noise at the lowest possible levels.
It looks like very okay. Soft.
Yes. Soft. Yeah. Okay, so here are examples. This is, concentrate about on what happens here and here. These are the responses to the tone alone. Okay, as function of level. So you see again the onset responses, mostly onset responses. Okay, these are the responses to noise plus tone. As function of the tone level, it's the same, the level here and here, the levels are the same. Okay? And again, you see this strong suppression. In some cases, the transition is more abrupt. In other cases, it's somewhat less abrupt. But usually, it's pretty abrupt. Yes. Okay, now here again, what happens is that this happens also at sometimes suppression occurs at levels which may be below the threshold of the tone in silence. For example, in this case. Okay, in this case, the threshold for tone in silence is here, but the level at which the suppression occurs is 5 to 10 dB below.
Okay.
Well. In this case,
yeah.
I think it's just noise in the response. Each one of these is one neuron. These are five different neurons.
Okay.
The cortical neuron responds to a given tone, so it's frequency sensitive, but you only get one spike.
Yes.
Okay. So about how many cycles does it need to listen to before you get the one spike?
Well. The shortest latency would be about 10 milliseconds. The time that the information should go should arrive to the cortex is, let's say, 8 milliseconds. So you have 2 or 3 milliseconds.
It has to know what frequency it is if the latency is so short.
Okay, and I talk here about this. These neurons have the best frequencies of, let's say, between 2 and 20 kilohertz. So you're talking about a number of
few cycles,
yes. Yes.
So the noise was fixed.
Yes, exactly.
And the color don't tell me much about
Yeah, I mean, yes, yes. It's mostly for beauty sake.
The other thing I noticed in the previous slide, it looked like you were only getting noise response to the wide bandwidth.
Yeah. These are all taken at the widest noise bands that I tested. Okay. Okay, one thing that we actually tested the responses of neurons with intercellular recordings. What I'm going to show now very fast is the fact that with intercellular recording, you see exactly the same phenomenon. Okay? Here are the responses of three neurons to the modulated noise bands. The blue line is for wide noise bands, and the green line is for the narrower noise bands. Okay, and you can see the same effect as with extracellular recordings. The locking tend to be stronger to the, this is a sort of the typical example. The locking tend to be stronger to the wide band noise than to the narrow band noise. And this looks like, in the intercellular recording, this looks like simple energy summation. So the nonlinearity in the spikes probably has to do with threshold. The effect with spikes is much stronger. The locking, the difference between locking to narrow noise band and wide noise band is much stronger with spikes than with intracellular recording. So unless we really sample very different population of neurons, which is possible, it looks like the wideband facilitation in spikes is mostly the effect of threshold.
What are the different families?
These are three neurons. And we have also neurons that don't lock to any of them. Okay, this is just the onset responses and then nothing else.
So all the stuff of averaging over frequency is done before you get to the cortex.
That's the final point. Okay, here I have eight neurons. I tried to put a lot of data into this slide just to show you that we have a lot of neurons that we recorded from. So what you see is the following thing. The red lines are the responses to the noise bands when it is presented alone. Okay, these are wide noise bands always. Okay, and most neurons will give you relatively nice locking to the noise when it's presented alone. The green line is the response to the tone, to a tone alone. Okay, and in most cases I chose it such that there's no response to the tone. Okay, at a level which is below the threshold, response threshold to the tone alone. Okay? The blue line is the response to the sum of the two stimuli. So the blue line is the response to the green plus red.
Are those individual traces?
No, these are averaged for 20 repetition each. Yes, and spikes were clipped before averaging. Okay, but you can see it also in a single trace. The traces are, single traces are pretty nice. Okay. So what you see is the suppression. You can see the suppression of the envelope locking caused by the addition of the tone. The tone was added at the time of the dashed line. Okay, so you can see again the complete suppression or very, very strong suppression of the phase of the envelope locking at the level of the membrane potential of the neuron. So in fact, we have here a direct correlate, the suppression of the envelope locking occurs at the level of the membrane potential. What? These are auditory cortex. This is auditory cortex.
But this is having to do with the synaptic input coming into the cell.
Yes. Okay. So obviously, the next thing that we wanted to do was to record in the MGB.
But you get the same results if you had hyperpolarized the cell and okay. Cut off the spike.
Okay, so we tried to record in under different depolarization states. For some reasons, we tend to lose the neurons when we hyperpolarize them. So we did a lot of recordings when we depolarize them, but we have relatively little amount of data when we hyperpolarize them.
What are the AFPs of these spikes look like?
Almost no.
Okay.
Well, almost no AHP. What?
I mean, the danger is that if you're getting a lot of spikes, spikes in some neurons have a very strong actor hypothesization,
yeah,
could completely bias your result, just depending on the number of spikes.
Yeah. But
so it's
the time scale here is much longer than the time scale of a spike.
I mean, that doesn't matter. You could still have a long, very deep AHP after a spike.
Yes.
That if you had a lot of spikes, could just effectively, and then you clip off, you know,
the upper sign.
No, but there are spikes.
There are spikes.
No, when there is no responsive bacillus, then there goes no spike. It goes together.
But we don't know what's happening here.
Is depolarized? No, here no. This is done without any depolarization. Data here.
But it's an intracellular recording,
yes,
so you don't know what's.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
If they're effectively depolarized, you
may not see the current. Okay, let me skip all of this. Is the data. So let's go now to the MGB. In MGB, we recorded again with extracellularly. And basically, you see the same thing, okay? The disappointing result for us in this story is the fact that in the MGB you see the same thing. You see the locking to the envelope of the masker. I commented about it with the bird song. These neurons tend to follow better the stimulus to start with than the cortical neurons. These are responses to the noise alone. Wait. These are responses to noise band alone.
Okay.
Wide band noise in red and narrow band noise in black.
Why is this surprising?
No, this is not surprising. Okay. This is what you see. Wait. Yeah. This is what you see in extracellular recordings in MGB when you do the experiment of putting the noise and adding the tone to it. Okay, now, this is the disappointing result. Okay, you see the suppression, the bars here below this part of the figure is the response to the noise alone. Okay, and here I start to add the tone to it. I get this full suppression. I get the full suppression at the level of the MGB. Okay, so this is a disappointing result because what we see in the CMR at the level of the cortex looks like it's already exists at the level of the spikes in the MGB. But this doesn't change the morale of the story, if you want. The final point is that what I have here, although it's already present at the level of the MGB, is I have the situation in which I have a strong sound, I add to it a very weak sound, and I get a very strong effect.
The moral is the same, but the morale isn't.
Okay. Let me just show you very fast the last kind of data that we have about the cortex. Here, the context is, again, I switch completely context. The experiment is really very simple. I just present pure tones to the neurons. The pure tones are presented in blocks, and in each block, I have a different distribution of probabilities for the different frequencies of the pure tones. In most experiments, we use two frequencies in each block. One of the frequency occurred very often, 90% of the time. The other frequency occurred 10% of the time. And then we switched the roles and presented blocks of the same two frequencies, but with the opposite probabilities. So this is really an experiment of adaptation. Okay, I'm asking whether the response to the tones depends on the probability of occurrence within a block. Okay, so they are once every 736 milliseconds, precisely. That's the shortest possible time in our setup between stimulus to stimulus, and the length is 200 milliseconds, 230 milliseconds. Okay, now here's the frequency tuning curve the frequency response area of a neuron, and you can maybe distinguish between the two lines here. Okay, the two lines are the two frequencies separated by 10%, 1.1 frequency ratio between the two. Okay, and they are presented at reasonably high above threshold levels. We use 40 dB above the BF threshold of the neuron. So these are relatively loud sounds. Now, here are the responses of the same neuron to the same stimulus when in red, when the stimulus was rare, in blue, when the stimulus was common. Okay, and the black is a control situation in which the two stimuli appear 50% of the time. Okay, and what you see is a significant difference between the responses when the stimulus is common. When the stimulus is common, it's much more depressed when it's rare. Okay, the point is that in this case, the two stimuli are the two stimuli that are presented here. So they are really within, very deep inside the tuning curve of the neuron. In terms of the shape of the tuning curve, the neurons should respond to them in the same way. And nevertheless, it knows how to distinguish between them in terms of the adaptation properties. Okay, we tested the neuron at, if we look, instead of 1.1, 10% difference in frequency, we look at the frequency ratio of 1.44, 44% difference, then the effect is much larger. And at 4% in this neuron, there was a very small effect, which was still significant. In fact, we find a very large number of neurons in which at 4% we still have significant differences between the responses of the neurons to a tone when it's rare and when it's common.
I'm sorry, wait.
Yes.
4% is the difference in frequency?
Yeah. These are two, here are the two frequencies. These are the response to the same frequency when the other frequency in the block was 1.04 of that frequency.
And what is the half width of the, sorry, the 3 dB width of the...
These two points are at 1.1 ratio, so they're...
Okay, so this comes down, this threshold comes down. What's the 3 dB width?
You should take it really at this level, because this is the level at which we tested the neurons.
Well, I don't know. What is the width of the peak?
Okay, so the width of the peak, near threshold? The Q10 of this neuron, which is something like 2, which means that it's a measure, it's an auditory measure.
I don't know what that means, but
the 10 dB width is 0.45, is 1.5. Okay? In these terms, okay, so this would correspond to the 10 dB, okay, and this corresponds to an order of magnitude better.
Yes.
The ratio between F1 and F2 is 1.44. Yes. Yes. Okay. Okay, so these are population averages for a subsample. By now we have, in the last few months, we collected more data of this kind. So now we have much more data. So you can see that there are two things here. First of all, the size of the effect we have nicely as a function of the frequency difference between the two tones. Okay.
So just to summarize the discussion.
Yes.
Your point is that at frequency differences that are small compared to the width,
yes,
somewhat sets
you
the
have
scale,
stimulus you nice specific adaptation.
Okay.
See, yeah.
So that's why this is
yes.
kind of special.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
But,
okay.
But that goes away at
very tiny.
This is still significant here. It's small, but it's significant.
Yes, that's nice.
Okay. And the other thing.
Wait.
Yes.
So that's including both the low frequency being rare and the.
Yeah. we always present the, them in the two roles because we have to compare the same frequency in the in its role of common and its role as rare. What? These are averaged across the two frequencies and many neurons. Okay. Now, one, the two points is that the size of the effect becomes larger, and the other point is that the effect really happens much more it's much more pronounced at the later response components, which are much weaker than the onset response, but most of the effect is there. And this is sort of reminiscent of something called mismatch negativity. Whoever knows what it is, and it's a component of the mismatch negativity. It's an evoked response potential, ERP component, that is used as a signal of detection of change between between the physical properties of stimuli. And, so this is some sort of neuronal correlate of mismatch negativity. Okay. The effect also behaves very nicely with respect to the probability of the stimuli. If you manipulate the probability, these are data from one neuron where we tested the neuron with blocks, with three different kind of blocks, a 10-90%, a 30-70%, and a 50-50%. And these are the response to one of the frequencies, and this is the response to the other frequencies. And at first, we plotted the spike counts as function of the log odds, and we got straight lines, and Tali Tishbi was very happy about it. But then we replotted it as function of probability, and we got also straight lines without taking the logs. No, well, the convexity of the function of the log odds relative to the probability is very small, so you can't really distinguish between that. And this is just to remind you that 10% and 4% are really within the tuning curve of the peripheral neurons. Okay, so we really get stimulus-specific adaptation for frequency differences that are narrower than the bandwidths of the peripheral inputs. Oh, no. This is data from the MGB. This was the first neuron we recorded in the MGB, but since then we have now something like 30 neurons in the MGB. So the stimulus-specific adaptation really occurs in cortex. So this is a cortical phenomenon. It's about as narrow as that.
It's about the same. So yes. What that means is that although you can pick an interval that's within the width, another cell it'll be
slightly. Yeah. Yes.
There could be a cell that will respond almost completely to one of those stimuli and not at all to another. There could be an MGB neuron.
Yes.
That could respond.
Some of them, yes. The narrowest tuned could do that. But the cortical neurons are wider than the MGB neurons. And tuning widths tend to slightly decrease when you go from periphery to inferior colliculus and MGB, and then increase again when you go to cortex. Yes, of course, but that for the 10%, at the limit, you could argue that this is so. But 4% is already splitting the MGB neurons too.
Can you get back to the curve you had before? So
this is the periphery. This is not the zonal fiber.
I'm sorry for dwelling on this time averaging issue, but if you measure this tuning curve, how long does the neuron integrate for? Can you watch this thing actually?
Yeah, this has been tested. This has been tested. Well, here in the auditory nerve fibers, you get the same answer for 10 millisecond, 50 millisecond, 100 millisecond tones. It's just your sensitivity to change in firing rate is greater. But there are not big differences. The neurons, auditory nerve fiber neurons, tend to respond to a sound in a very stereotypical manner. So now people did sort of ideal observer models to check integration times, and the answer is that it's fast, and the differences are not large.
And is that with, I mean, is that consistent with, that's like with 1/10 milliseconds?
No.
No.
No. This is again in the periphery. This is 1/10 milliseconds is 100 hertz.
It's broader.
Yes, it's broader. That's some people comment about it. The temporal acuity of these neurons is better than you would expect from the frequency selectivity. It's
I thought you said that this was broader.
Wait.
Which would mean that the theoretical limit, the Fourier transformers would actually have a narrower.
The temporal acuity is better. It's 10 milliseconds. You would expect it to be 30 milliseconds. Based on this width.
I thought you said so it's not, it's the width not. Here was broader.
What? Yeah, I mean, if you would look at this neuron and you would try to take the Fourier transform of this, you will get an impulse response that's longer.
So what is it? Is this
no.
A statement that the brain...
Not 10 milliseconds, 1 millisecond. What? I mean, the temporal resolution of the... Oh, I see what you... No, I was talking about different data. You were right. You were right. I mean, the temporal resolution of these neurons is about 1 millisecond. Okay, it's about 1 millisecond.
And I mean that corresponds. That's
within 1 millisecond.
That's what you're saying.
Yes. So it's not consistent. No, that's the statement that I made. Okay, the temporal resolution is about 1 millisecond. Within 1 millisecond, I will know what the frequency of the tone is. Okay, between in 1 millisecond, they can detect gaps of 1 millisecond in the sound. They can detect amplitude modulation of 1 kilohertz. Okay, they will lock to an amplitude modulation of 1 kilohertz superimposed on their best frequency. They will phase lock up to about 1 kilohertz without any problems. They can see things that happened within the order of magnitude of 1 millisecond, but the bandwidth is much larger than you would expect from that. The bandwidth is much narrower than you would expect narrower than you would expect from that. Yes, the bandwidth would be not 1 kilohertz, but 100 hertz. Yes, 100 hertz. This is basically because what limits the temporal resolution and what limits the spectral resolution are not the same things.
Well, this isn't quantum mechanics. There's nothing fundamentally wrong with that. Yeah.
Yes, yes. No, it's different mechanisms. It's just...
Sorry, just trying to understand.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. No, but, I mean, there's a lot of philosophy around it because you sort of get... best of two worlds, you get good frequency resolution and good temporal resolution, but it's really okay. So okay, so just to summarize, so what I showed, I mean the main thing that I wanted to show is the fact that we can interpret responses in primary auditory cortex in terms of processes of auditory source separation, and we can quantify it by the fact that neurons in the cortex with similar responses to tones, similar place in the tonotopic map, respond very differently to the same sounds, to the same complex sounds. And then there's the story of that rare stimuli are emphasized, and obviously all of what I told you require processing of sounds beyond spectrotemporal globe summation, as I showed you at the beginning of the talk. So you really need models that are that are more sophisticated than that, provided you and you uncover them. As I said at the beginning, you uncover these processes when you use mixtures. So you need to give these cortical neurons an interesting problem in order for these strongly nonlinear phenomena to emerge. And the last thing is that I showed you some of these properties are created gradually and are already apparent at the level of the MGB, and some of them are not. Yes?
So from the point of view of sort of behavior, if you look at animals that don't have a developed cortex, like reptiles, that don't have a neocortex, so they don't have an A1, I mean, do you see behaviorally the same issue of being able to pick out sort of what we're going to call these novel features out of the stimuli?
I have no idea.
Is there something special that happens when you finally have neocortex?
I have no idea. What I can tell you is that birds have CMR, the suppression of and the detection of weak tones in amplitude modulated tone in noise. Okay, they show this behaviorally. There are also neural correlates for this in birds, which do not have cortex. They do have an analog, okay, so it's filled in field L. This is Andreas Nieder and Georg Klump. What?
A good chunk of their talks up on the auditory
process. So you don't need cortex for this, but my guess is that you do need something above the inferior colliculus. Inferior colliculus exists also in reptiles.
Right.
Okay, so my guess is that you get to specific auditory scene analysis type of things above the inferior colliculus, but not necessarily need something that looks like cortex to do it.
So is this the place where you're going to put your electrodes next?
Inferior colliculus?
Yeah.
Thankfully, I have collaborators who do that for me. I want to stay in cortex. There are other questions that we didn't context. No. We know from part of the work that the people in Hopkins did that halocyanine is much better than barbiturates for the auditory system. But of course, it's still anesthetized. An awake cat is essentially impossible to do for practical reasons. Chronic recordings in awake cats are not because the preparation itself is impossible, but because of animal laws and things like that. So I'm not going to do awake cats next. It's there is a pretty good preparation of awake rabbit, which is much easier to. What? What did you say? The sound of the lettuce? Yes. You know why rabbits have long ears. It's for cooling purposes. It's a lot of skin without fur. So, yeah. But I don't know. I mean, rats, the problem with rats is that the low frequency hearing is not so good. So there are many kind of questions that you can't ask in rats. But we are going to test the CMR kind of things. We are going now to test in rats to see whether we see the same things. So that's an alternative possibility.
But why not the linear summation?
What? The Birdsong? To test this?
Yeah.
Now, the experiment that we design now, part of the characterization of the neuron is always this kind of blob estimation. We do it always. Okay, but this, my guess is that this will be the same in all animals and all neurons. It's so generic that there's no reason it won't work. This is a simple,
I'm talking about the summation of the main part and the noise.
Yeah. Oh, why not test this?
Yes.
Because we have the intercellular data. We want to test intercellular recordings in rats instead of cats. And we have the data set for the intercellular recordings for the CMR stimuli. So we want to use this as a basis for comparisons between rats and cats, intercellularly. Okay. Noise detection is auditory source separation, but it's not noise. No, I mean, in one case it was noise. It was noise when the main was tone. In the other case, it was detecting the tone when the noise was the strong part. And in the third case, it was detecting the rare tone within the common tones. So it's not really noise that's the crucial thing here. The crucial thing here is that you have contrast. I don't know. I mean, the cats.
No, that's not what he's saying. He's saying that there are neurons that respond to the main part, but there are other neurons that respond only to the backup. So in that sense, it seems credible. You don't want everybody to respond to the.
Yeah. Well, I have a problem here. In the first set of data that we collected with the bird songs, almost all neurons responded to the noise. Looked like they respond to the noise. Okay. We then collected more data, and as we collected more data, the picture became much more murky, as always. So now we have still a large set of neurons that respond to the noise, but we really have now neurons that look like they respond to the main too. But the point is that the emergence of neurons that respond, it looks like the neurons that respond to the noise emerge at the level of the cortex. They do not exist at the level of the below. Yes.
Warming up for it.